7 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. I'm Gene Gumbs, and I am pleased to welcome Pete Abraham of the Boston Globe to the show. Good morning, Mr. Abraham. How are you?
Hey, Gene. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Listen, a couple days in the Boston Globe, you had a story about the Red Sox bullpen and your belief that it would be silly for them to kind of cheap out on a closer. Do you have a sense that Dombrowski is content with where things are, or do you think he's waiting to see what happens with the Craig Kimbrell market?
Well, I think he's waiting to see what happens with the entire market, not just Kimbrell. And I just find it kind of funny, you know, that at the winter meetings last month, he was saying, oh, you know, we're very happy with Matt Barnes and Ryan Brazier, and you know, we go into the season with them, and we don't necessarily need to make an addition. Meanwhile, you know, Joe Kelly is signed with the Dodgers, and Craig Kimbrell's a free agent, and those were two of the three guys who pitched their most games last year out of the bullpen. So I don't know that they could go into the season missing two important players like that and not do anything to replace them, especially, you know, considering that they have such a good team, a chance to repeat. I don't see them. It would seem foolish to have that kind of team and not take care of business in the bullpen and risk not being able to you know, you can't guarantee repeating, obviously, but not putting themselves in a position where they could repeat.
I was kind of surprised that they re-signed Tyler Thornburg, and I recently saw that they've signed Carson Smith to a minor league contract. It almost seems like he's stockpiling arms just in case they can't land a guy like Kimbrell, Ottavino, or Robertson. I mean, could that be what he's doing?
Well, it certainly, in both of those cases, it's very inexpensive. Carson Smith was signed to a minor league contract. He's not even going to be physically ready to pitch when spring training starts. So that's sort of a not long term, but something where maybe they hope he can help in the second half of the season. And the same thing with Thornburg. His contract was less than $1.5 million. If it works out in spring training, fine. If it doesn't work out in spring training, they can release him and not pay that money. So I know in my experience with relief pitchers, it's quite often the guys who were injured or ineffective the year before who were then good the following year, and vice versa sometimes. A guy who pitches a lot the previous year, sometimes, you know, he feels the after effects in the season coming after. So it wouldn't surprise me if either Smith or Thornburg proved to be helpful. I think with most major league teams, you try to bring as many guys into camp as you can and sort it out and hope that you find, whether it's another Ryan Brazier or whoever it may be, somebody like that who can help you.
There's a lot of talk about that top luxury tax and that signing a high-priced closer is going to put them over the max threshold. How big a concern do you think that is to Sox management?
Well, you know, I think the way the luxury tax is put together now, it's a lot different than it was in the previous CBA, where everybody seemed like they were terrified of going over it and what it would be a terrible thing. I think now it's largely a money issue. And if you go over, you're going to be taxed on how much you go over. And last year, the Red Sox ended up spending $11 million in luxury tax. Now, that trade in return for a world championship seems pretty insignificant when you consider how much money the Red Sox bring in. Now, I don't think it's something you want to do just perpetually, because it does affect your spot in the draft. It does affect how much money you can spend internationally. But when you have a team that you feel is at the verge of being able to do something great, I don't think that money is prohibitive. And when you look at the overall picture of the Red Sox financially, it seems weird to say $11 or $12 million is a drop in the bucket. But for a team like that, it really is a drop in the bucket. And you look at what the Dodgers, I think, are poised to, you know, whether it's to sign Bryce Harper or somebody else, I think teams realize that there are seasons when you have enough talent where it probably makes sense to go for it and compile as, you know, get as many good players as you can and not worry about the tax until the following year.
Well, to switch gears a little bit, one of the X factors going into this year is Dustin Pedroia. You know, if he's healthy, your defense at second base obviously becomes better. You get more production from the position that you've had before. Do you think they're going to try to ease him into things or in the spring, or do you think they're going to try to find out fairly quickly where he's at and if he's somebody they can count on?
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of a mystery, because our understanding is he was going to start a running program sometime this month, and that would determine a lot. You know, obviously he's going to need to be able to run. So if come January he shows them that he can run, that's going to open things up to have maybe a more active spring training. And if he doesn't, obviously they're probably back in the same position they were last year, where they're out to wait and see. And the thing about Dustin, and I get this from a lot of fans who email me or respond on social media, they all seem to think that, if he can't play, he's just going to go away. Well, he's not going away. He has two more years left on his contract.
Right.
And whether it's, whether it's being on a disabled list or whatever it may be, that he's not just going to retire. They're not just going to let him go. He's not walking away from $40 million. So this is a long-term project, however it works out. They're going to give him every chance to play. If he goes back on the DL, he goes back on the DL. I do think they're getting to a point, though, where they're going to have to decide whether this is something, they're going to go through every year or go out and either find a permanent second baseman or develop, whether it's Brock Holt or Zhu Weilin, one of those guys. There's even talk of Michael Chavis could do it. Find somebody else who they can look at as their second baseman, from a full-time basis. And whatever you get out of Pedroia, you get out of Pedroia.
What about the catcher spot this year? That three-headed monster thing seemed a little bit unwieldy there last year, Pete. There's been talk about them maybe trying to move one of these guys. Where do you think they're at with that?
Yeah, I think they will move them. Last year, it wasn't a good fit. It weakened their bench to have Blake Swihart at times because they really didn't have any role for him. Vasquez had a kind of a rally at the end of last season offensively and gained the trust of Alex Cora in the postseason. He's the guy they want to be their catcher. I mean, they signed him to a contract at the end of spring training last year. They look at him as a combination of at least some offensive potential and good defense. Sandy Leone is as good as he's been defensively, especially working with Chris Sale. It's hard to use him as your everyday catcher offensively. So I think Swihart's the guy they're probably going to try to trade. It would be the best thing for Blake to give him a chance somewhere else. And he would probably be the guy. And they're not going to get back a notable major league player in return for Blake Swihart. But they could certainly get back a young pitcher who has some ability, somebody that the Red Sox can put into their farm system and maybe someone who can help them down the road. And I think just from opening up the roster, making them a little more versatile, that would be the best thing that they could do.
Well, I want to get to the Hall of Fame in a second, but there was one thing I saw that came down last night that Troy Tulowitzki just signed with the New York Yankees, I guess pending a physical for the Major League minimum. Do you think that affects what the Yankees might be considering doing in terms of their pursuit of Manny Machado?
Supposedly it does not. That's what the reports were, that it just does not preclude them signing Machado. And the thing with Tulo is it's a completely no-risk proposition for the Yankees. If he can play, they get him for the major league minimum because Toronto is on the hook for his full salary. And if he can't play, they release him without any obligation. So I that's just a move, I think, where Tulo's always wanted to play for the Yankees. He grew up idolizing Jeter. I'm sure he looks at it as, if he is going to make a comeback, this is a good spot for him.
Okay.
With Didi Gregorius coming back from Tommy John surgery, he's going to be out for a while during the season, at least the first half, probably a little bit into the second half. So this is an opportunity for him to play shortstop, which he values. He doesn't want to become a utility player. But the Yankees still could sign Machado, could try to convince him to play third base and either trade Andujar or try to play Andujar at first base.
You've had kind of a cool thing in your career. You're one of the few guys I know that have had an opportunity to be a beat writer for both the Yankees and the Red Sox. And having seen it on both sides, how much truth is there, or do you believe there's truth in that these teams really pay attention to what the other team is doing and make moves based on what the other team is doing? Does that really happen?
Well, I think that was more a case back in the day of George Steinbrenner, that if the Red Sox did something notable, Steinbrenner would, treat that as, well, now we need to do something to counter. And Larry Lucchino, I think, bought into that, too, that the Red Sox and Yankees were always fighting and had to do something to counter each other. I don't think the current ownership groups and general managers feel that way necessarily. I know Brian Cashman, the job of the Yankees is to beat the Red Sox and vice versa. But I don't think Cashman would make any kind of move hastily because the Red Sox did something. And he's proven that. And he didn't do anything out of the ordinary when they went and got Chris Sale or David Price or J.D. Martinez. And the same thing has been true for the Red Sox under Dave Dombrowski, that they haven't reacted and done something they didn't necessarily want to do because the Yankees made a move. Now, that said, I think from a business standpoint, both teams look at each other as being kind of almost good for each other, that it's good when there's the Red Sox and Yankees are both good. It's good for ticket sales. It's good for television. Mm-hmm. It's good for marketing. And having covered both teams, the fan bases of both teams probably wouldn't want to hear this, but they're a lot alike.
Yeah.
When you look at, the amount of money that they spend, the loyalty of their fans, the fact that they're teams that are willing to take chances, they're teams that are driven by superstar players. They are a lot alike, and I think last year especially, it's good for baseball when the Red Sox and Yankees are good teams. I think that makes baseball a lot more exciting.
Well, we got the Hall of Fame announcement coming up in a couple of weeks. It looks like Mariano Rivera is a lock. It seems like Roy Halladay may get enough support to get in as well. There's a lot of momentum for Edgar Martinez in his final year on the ballot. How did you fall on him? I know you're a Hall of Fame voter, especially considering a lot of his time was spent as DH, and we're going to be debating that a lot in the next few years when David Ortiz comes on the ballot.
Yeah, the Globe is going to do a reveal of all of the guys who vote from the Globe in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
And we're putting together a package this week. But a couple of years ago, I did start voting for Edgar Martinez, and I can tell you that I continue to vote for him. Part of it was actually Mariano Rivera was among the people who convinced me. And a lot of times when I run across players and I get a chance to talk to them, I'll ask them about the Hall of Fame. And Mariano told me that in his entire career, Edgar Martinez was the toughest batter that he faced.
Wow.
And that had some influence on me as I was considering, different guys. And, the other part of it is, I think when you're a Hall of Fame voter, you need to look at the game not like maybe a Hall of Fame voter did 20 years ago. You need to look at it at the way the game is played now. And DH is a legitimate position. It might not be a position where you need a glove, but it's certainly a legitimate position. There are guys who have made a very good career out of being a designated hitter.
Right.
And certainly Edgar was probably the first of those. David Ortiz was certainly maybe the best of those. And it would have been hard for me to justify voting for David Ortiz and then having not voted for Edgar Martinez. So that was kind of how I flipped on Edgar Martinez. I think Mariano should be unanimous. He won't be unanimous because you can't get 700 people to agree on everything. but he's probably going to, I would imagine he falls, no more than five votes shy of being unanimous. I don't know why anybody, unless you're trying to draw attention to yourself.
Right.
And trying to make news and trying to get everybody to pay attention to you. I don't know why anybody would not vote for Mariano Rivera. He's not just one of the best pitchers in baseball history. He's one of the best players in baseball history.
Yep. What about guys like Bonds and Clemens? It seems like the stance on some of these steroid guys is softening a little bit, Pete.
Yeah, when I first started voting, I didn't vote for either of those guys, and I since have. And the way I looked at it was when Bud Selig got voted into the Hall of Fame by the Veterans Committee. To me, it made it pretty hypocritical to say, well, I'm not going to vote for Bonds and Clemens, because as Commissioner, Selig had an opportunity to put in strong drug rules and performance-enhancing drug rules, and he never did. It wasn't until Congress got involved that Major League Baseball was prodded into putting out these rules.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, I think every baseball fan knows this, MLB looked the other way at steroid use. They thought Sosa and McGuire was great for baseball. They thought Bonds was good for baseball. Here's Roger Clemens in his, in his late 30s, still pitching well. And everybody just turned the other way, and everybody knew what was happening. And when I say everybody, I include the media. I think the fans didn't really care. Teams didn't care. Major League Baseball certainly didn't care. And the Major League Baseball Players Association didn't care either. Now you're asking writers, in some cases, say 15 years later, to be the guys who punished these players because they were using steroids or whatever they were using. I don't think it's right to say, well, Major League Baseball and the Players Association looked the other way for years and years. Now you want sports writers who don't have enough information in terms of who did what, when they did it, how they did it, how much it affected them.
Right.
To say, okay, well, we're going to be the ones who clean this issue up. I don't think that's right. And the other part of it is, when I went into it, I was very moralistic. I thought, well, the Hall of Fame is this sacred place, and it's such a wonderful thing, and you can't sully the Hall of Fame by having Bonds and Clemens in it. Well, the Hall of Fame is a museum. It's not a church.
Right.
And the you know, to yeah. me, it reflects what the game was like at the time.
Yeah.
And there was a time when there weren't black players who were playing. There was a time they didn't have lights. There was a time the mound was higher. There was a time that nobody hit home runs, that everybody bunted and stole. And there's players in the Hall of Fame from all of those eras. And there are certainly guys in the Hall of Fame who are terrible people
yeah.
for one reason or another. So I think if you put Bonds and Clemens in, it reflects what was going on in the game at the time that they were playing. I just think it wouldn't be right to have a museum and just ignore the fact that these two guys played the game and were very successful at it. And yeah, there were things going on at the game at the time. But you know what? There's probably things going on in the game right now that we don't know about that we'll be talking about in terms of the Hall of Fame 20 years from now.
Well, I kind of look at it two ways, too. One of the ways I look at it is I always say Bonds and Clemens would have been Hall of Famers without the drugs. But I also draw a line now, and I wonder if any sports writers are doing this, that, look, you know, guys that were pre-testing, you know, and you don't know who did or who didn't, but it wasn't technically illegal, I have more... I have more empathy for them than I do guys like Manny Ramirez who failed drug tests. You know, to me and Robinson Cano, same thing.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't vote for Manny Ramirez for just that very reason. Was that there was a red line that was drawn, and everybody came together, the union and Major League Baseball and everybody else said, okay, here's the deal. You know, here's what you can't do, and if you do it, here's how you're going to get punished. And everybody knew what it was. And Manny, he got caught twice.
Right.
The second time he got caught, he just retired rather
yeah.
than face his punishment. So to me, I don't vote for Manny, and I'm comfortable not voting for Manny because he knew what was going on, and he decided to do it anyway.
Right.
And that's, you know, flat-out cheating compared to what everybody else was doing in the game at that time. Whereas for all of the, you know, do I think Bonds and Clemens probably did something? Sure, I do. They still have yet to be positively tied to any kind of drug use. I mean, the federal government went after both of them and couldn't convict them. And the same is true for a lot of other players. None of these guys were ever tested positive or ever were directly linked to drugs or anything like that. So I do think there's a line, and whether it's Manny Ramirez or Robbie Cano or you know D. Gordon, I think I'm comfortable excluding them. Because at some point they did put in drug testing and everybody knew about it.
Pete, listen, thank you very much. Appreciate your time this morning and great stuff. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, Jim.
All right.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Have a great day. Pete Abraham here on Sports Country Radio, and certainly appreciate his input into what's going on in Major League Baseball, especially with the Hall of Fame. Pete, a longtime voter for the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he certainly, I think, has the right idea in terms of the steroids thing. And I know there's still a lot of guys that absolutely will not vote for guys because of the whole steroid issue. But I think Pete hit it right on the head. They're asking sports writers to be the guys who are going to dole out the punishment without all the information.